This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. New fiction from the South, this week on Soundings.
You see, Worth began, the problem is Joe Crane doesn't believe we can do anything together to make society better. We should just cut our losses, you see, and get on to the next life. That makes it tough to be in government because you can't do anything. You just walk around putting people in jail for disagreeing with you. Now, I have this other view, that people acting together can make society better. I didn't say perfect, or even more moral, just better in an ordinary way. More jobs, better schools, that kind of thing. I believe in doing what you can with what you know, and I'm modest about how much you can know, especially about what the good Lord wants.
Novelist John Russell reading from his new book, Favorite Sons. I'll talk with John Russell in just a moment. Later on the show this week, novelist Luke Wisnett talks about his new book, Watching TV with the Red Chinese. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. John Russell is an attorney and writer. His first novel is Favorite Sons. It's the story of a 50-year friendship between two men that also traces the emergence of the New South. In the two main characters of Favorite Sons, a politician named Worth Patterson and a businessman named Roger Albright, John Russell recounts his fascination with the World War II generation. Here were men, says Russell, who grew up in the Great Depression, defeated Nazism, built the world's dominant economy, then went on to contain and defeat communism. But Favorite Sons is also a last hurrah for the World War II generation. I asked John Russell to explain.
I suppose the guiding principle, one of them is how do you grow up as a man and live a good life?
Mm-hmm. An old question.
An old question.
How do you put a particular Southern spin on that?
I think that you have an example that the Southern boys grow up in an atmosphere where there is a kind of tradition, a sense of duty about mm-hmm. things. What does that mean? I mean, and then, of course, the political question comes into play, because duty and loyalty mean different things. Does it mean that are you loyal and dutiful to a set of philosophical or religious beliefs that lead you to fight the world around you, or are you dutiful and loyal to an idea of progress which makes you go forward and take chances and risks?
Uh-huh. At one level, you give us a replay in Favorite Sons of a very fierce political battle in North Carolina political history, the 1950 contest between Willis Smith and Frank Porter Graham. Tell me how you came to that episode fictionally and reproduced it in this novel.
Very interesting question, because to me, the fictional... The reason that you would write a story like that in fiction, to my mind, is as follows. We have something quite remarkable in North Carolina in that we have young men who fought each other tooth and nail in 1950. And I'm talking about men like, say, Terry Sanford and Bill Friday on the one hand, who were allies and aides to Mr. Graham. Then you have Jesse Helms on the other side, who was about their same age and fighting tooth and nail on the side of Willis Smith. Mm-hmm. And then you have... That was a tremendous epical event in our history. Then 25 years later, you have the same thing, the same guys. It's a remarkable kind of political environment, and one which begs for fiction, because mm-hmm. I think you only explain something like that by dipping into literature or art. It's uh-huh. it's deeply psychological. It's deeply historical too.
How do you present a fictionalized account of political tensions like that, John Russell, without necessarily landing on one side or the other? Or in fact, do you?
I think you do. I mean, because I think that. it depends on the characters that you choose. I mean, you make that decision very early. If your book is going to be about people like Roger and Worth, who are clearly on the progressive side in politics, then unless you're going to write a 300-page book about people you don't like, then that's the side you're going to end up on. But I think it's very important, and a reason to make this fiction and not history, is that this is a human dimension. I mean, Senator Helms is a powerful and profound force, not because he is, you know, not because he's evil or bad, but because he touches something profound in a lot of people. And you have to get to the bottom of that to figure it out. And the way you get to it is that I think that he understands in a funny way Roger and, well, I'm mixing up fiction and reality here. Senator Helms understands Senator Sanford at a very deep level, and has a profound reaction against that. But it's a reaction that comes from understanding. It's a reaction that comes from empathy. You come from the same background, but you see the world in a different way.
This is the character, I take it, that you have in mind in Favorite Sons. Well, we have a number of characters. One of them is Joe Crane. Another one is Gnarly Ferguson. That is to say, humble origins. Ambition is a word that figures in this in this equation, but really we're talking about matters of the heart. We're talking about politics translated into psychological exercises that we don't normally associate with the political. Am I right?
Right, but I mean, I think we have to associate that with the political. I mean, if you want to understand, you know, democracy is, you know, it begins with individuals, and they all go vote, and in mass, you know, they make a decision. We make a decision,
right.
But that those decisions are individual, and they are matters of the heart. I think that when you get when you talk about Joe Crane, who is on the sort of the right wing side of things in my book. And how he reacts initially to Worth and Roger, who are on the other side, I think you have to look at it as an individual thing. To him, to Joe Crane, Worth and Roger are insiders. They come up through a college that grooms them for leadership. They're befriended by powerful men. They're given money and resources, a sort of establishment blessing. And he thinks that they are wrong.
And it's time to change them.
And it's time to change them. Yeah. And so he sees that, and he sees himself as an outsider. And his bitterness and his drive and his skill really is born out of a desire to be, to displace them.
All right. John Russell, do you intend your book Favorite Sons as not only a political history in fictional terms, but is this an emblem of things to come in politics in the South? Are you setting yourself up here as some sort of a prophet?
Well, I hope it's not a literal prophecy, because the good guys lose in my book. I mean, you know, did I give something away? I didn't really mean to. I think that what's happening in national politics, you know, in some sense is similar to what happens in my book. In a way, you've got a generational. Let me put it this way: in my book, the men involved who are fighting each other over these decades, whether they're on the left side or the right side, eventually they come to a point in their late middle age where they just don't understand the world anymore. They just don't understand the world anymore.
Things change. And they're not always able to nail it down.
And a lot, you know, I spend a lot of time at the end of this book, a lot of chapters I didn't really plan on spending, letting these men figure out what to do with their lives. Mm-hmm. Because it's devastating to them when they don't understand the world anymore. I mean, here are guys who are at the top of their game. I mean, they run everything. And then one day they wake up and they don't understand the world. And if you look at what happened in the last election, that's what happened to George Bush. I mean, here was a guy who, by all accounts, is on top of the world. I mean, literally, you know, after the Gulf War. But he woke up one day and something had changed, and he just didn't understand anymore. And I think you could see that in his political campaign. It wasn't that he wasn't trying hard. Wasn't that he didn't have enough money. Wasn't that, you know, he wasn't fighting. He just didn't understand the world anymore.
Well, I could be cynical and say, look, that's the nature of politics. What's new? But to come back to this predictive sort of element in your book, the mixture of religion, politics, television. Is that what we're stuck with for a couple of cycles here?
I think that the I think religion and television. I think you're going to have that, but what I really think is going to happen. And I suppose I'm a fan of Arthur Schlesinger's 30-year cycle theory. You know, I mean, and he's Arthur Schlesinger is so proud of himself now. He wrote a wonderful piece in the New York Times about how his father's 30-year cycle theory predicts the liberal victory in 1992 and the rest of it. I mean, I think we're probably in for a decade of sort of rational, good government, Democratic Party politics. I think that's what's going to be happening. And I think that the religious right is probably going to be in the opposition for a while.
Going to go off and regroup and redefine itself.
That's right. And I think it's always going to be there because Americans, I mean, the reason it's going to be here is not for any manipulative or bad type of reason. The reason that religion is going to play a part in American politics is that we have an argument between ourselves. And part of my book is about this. We have an argument as to whether progress really works.
Is there such a thing as good for its own sake? I mean, you put dialogue like that into the mouths of these characters.
Yeah, I mean, if life on Earth is really about sin and redemption, which a good part of people in this state and across the country believe, then what's the use of politics at all?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if what life is about is sin and redemption and the next world, then if you extend yourself into the world of affairs and then as men and women attempt to build something better on Earth, isn't that kind of a sin? I mean, isn't that secular humanism?
Being very presumptuous, arrogant.
Arrogant, yes.
Presuming to change the world.
And I think that even though these views are not really expressed in such a naked philosophical fashion,
right,
you have a lot of people who since the beginning of the Republic have said that America is about individual discovery. It's about the discovering sin and trying to redeem oneself and go to the next world.
Or simply make the best of what we've got.
And make the best of what we've got. I mean, the Puritans founded a lot of this country. And so I think you've got that, and it's going to resonate throughout politics. And I think people who are on the other side of it, the dominant media, the secular establishment, have got to understand that the idea of progress is not a settled question in this country. And when I say progress, what I mean is, can you go into the world and extend yourself and make something better? I mean, extend yourself morally is what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, can you make compromises? Can you deal with people who are evil? For our greater good.
What the Puritans called depravity.
Yeah. Can you do that and then create a better human structure in life without losing one's soul?
Well, John Russell, I want to congratulate you on this book. It makes for great reading. It seemed to me you had a lot of fun with the Old South and the New and characters, real characters and people that you invented in putting the book together. Favorite Sons is available from Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill. John Russell, thanks for coming by the Humanities Center. I wish you well in your work.
Thanks, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Watching TV with the Red Chinese. Writer Luke Wisnett talks about his first novel, next on Soundings.
There's no sense of continuity anymore, and there might never have been, but it seems like there used to be. Now nobody knows what it is. This is a culture in decay, a culture in fragments. It's fragmenting more and more each day, even among the subcultures. There's 15 or 20 different value systems out there now. So, of course, there's no American novel anymore, no American book. There's no shared reality at all nowadays, with the possible exception of television.
Writer Luke Wisnett reading from his first novel, entitled Watching TV with the Red Chinese. The action of the book takes place around the time of the assassination of John Lennon in 1980. Watching TV with the Red Chinese is a bittersweet account of how American pop culture affects foreigners, in this case, three Chinese graduate students named Su, Hua, and Chen, who are studying in the American Midwest. Told to us through the narrative voice of a character named Dexter Mitchell, Watching TV with the Red Chinese draws on television as one of the organizing metaphors of American culture. I asked Luke Wisnett to explain.
I think one of the sub-themes of the book is that despite all of our multiculturalist sort of bent that we're on, or the kick that we're on now in the United States, there are some things that simply will not translate. Mm-hmm. The beginning of the book talks about meaning and order and shared knowledge if you know the code. And by the end of the book, I think there's a rejection of the idea that we all are the same and that we all can get along. It's a little bit of a bleak vision there, but I think there are definitely cultural differences.
Is that you, Luke Wisnett, talking, or is that the voice of this character, this narrator, Dexter, and the one who speaks to us in the pages of the novel?
I guess it's a little of both.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about that interplay between your experience and your imagination.
I think that Dex is emotionally fairly similar to the way I am, but I had to distance myself from him quite a bit. And in fact, the new book that I'm working on, there's nothing at all like me in it, because some of my friends have read this and said, "Oh, you're Dex." Well, I'm not Dex, but
let's come back to that phrase that you used here: order, meaning, shared knowledge, mm-hmm. the possibility of Americans and Chinese. You can name any sorts of pairings here, how they're going to sort of come to grips with one another in the modern world. One of your arguments, again, is that television is for better or worse, the device that brings them together. And I take it that, your idea here is it's for worse.
I think it is for worse. I think that television shows a lot of the worst parts of this culture. If you look at the amount of violence on television and how violence begats violence, the same thing with there's a great deal of sex on TV. There's a lot of superficiality and shallowness on television. And to judge a culture by an artifact, or a medium in this case, like that, is to miss the subtleties of it. Su understands this in the novel. He says something about how America is a vast series of systems, many different systems interacting, and so he doesn't want to make any generalizations about it. Hua, on the other hand, watches the television, reads the newspaper, reads about murders and homeless people and babies left in trash cans, and he condemns the culture outright.
Now, these are the two older of your three older, Chinese right. characters. Tell me about Chen. Here again, we have far more the most impressionable, the most vulnerable, the sweetest of the three characters. Mm-hmm. We don't want to let the cat out of the bag entirely. Let's say that he comes to an unhappy ending here. How do you move him toward that ending?
Chen is an innocent, and the aspects of American culture that he gets involved with are some of the darker aspects. I'll sit down and say that I'm going to write a story about jealousy or love or conflict between generations, and I'll find myself writing about this area where subcultures overlap.
You're also interested in the enormous influence, whether we're conscious of it or not, of our popular culture.
Yes.
On the what shall we call it, the deeper psychology of the way we live. For example, you have the death of John Lennon. A memorial service for Lennon is yes. one of the historical events that you use imaginatively in this novel. How so?
One way I do that is that historically in Cleveland, the John Lennon memorial or tribute happened on the Tuesday that his death was announced. He was killed on a Monday night, but most people found out about it on Tuesday. But in the book, I change it to Sunday. All over the world, Sunday was the day that most people mourned Lennon.
The radio stations
the radio
were
station,
silent.
Right, the uh-huh. silence and the gathering in Central Park in New York. So I changed that a little bit. But the John Lennon assassination, that event is one of the two historical events in the book that the characters all respond to, the other being Ronald Reagan's election in uh-huh. November of 1980. Uh-huh. And I can tell you that when it happened for me, I didn't have any specific response to John Lennon's death except, here it is, another murder, another handgun death like that. isn't this a sick society? Like many of us, you know, we respond to it and then we forget about it.
And what's the spin when we put the communist Chinese into this mix?
They don't understand it. But the American characters do feel it very deeply. Suzanne, who's been with Chen for a while now.
Is one of the characters in your book.
Right. Suzanne is Dexter's old girlfriend and has been seeing Chen for a while. When John Lennon is killed, it means so much to her, and she tries to explain it to Chen. He doesn't understand. And so for this one evening only, she comes back to Dexter.
Mm-hmm.
But I can remember when this happened. Like I said, I didn't have much response to it. Oh, this is awful. John Lennon was killed. 2 years later, I was at a party, and on the dance tape, John Lennon's song Imagine came on. Everyone at the party stood, put their arms around each other, swayed back and forth in a circle, this very sad little dance, and I suddenly realized for the first time what we had lost.
All right, now, let's take that in a couple of directions, Luke Wisnett. On the one hand, we can say, oh no, here we go again, you know, American maudlin sentimentality,
yes,
particularly from the standpoint of three Chinese students who look at this and say, is this as tough as it gets for these Americans? On the other hand, that really does have a wide and a shared meaning in our culture. Is it impossible that, for example, in your book, the Chinese, the Americans, you name the groups, that they're ever going to come to terms?
I don't know that there ever will be a coming to terms in that way.
Oh, you're a pessimist.
I am, yeah. I think in some ways this is a very bleak book. It's a very funny book to me.
Mm-hmm.
But toward the end of it, the message may be no, no, no.
What do you mean by this wonderful phrase, the theory of possible worlds? One of the characters in your book has a boyfriend who is something of a philosopher. He's also something of a roughneck. And around the action there, we have these words, the theory of possible worlds. What's going on?
Possible worlds is an idea that's come to us through Leibniz. It's been around several hundred years. And in analytic philosophy of the early 20th century was a way, and I'm simplifying tremendously here.
Sure, sure.
Was a way of showing the possible truth value of an if conditional or a counterfactual.
All right, now that's a little stuffy. That's a little academic, Luke. That's
your
philosophical colleagues. What does it have to do with fiction? What does it have to do with the way people in novels live their lives and the way you create those lives?
I think it's an essentially human thing that we wonder, what if?
Uh-huh.
What if things were different? What if I had not missed that train? What if I had gone to this school instead of that school? And the theory of possible worlds is an attempt to account for that what if.
All right, now again, we don't want to let the conclusion of your novel let the cat out of the bag, but did you make the choice that you made about the conclusion of the novel with respect to one of these Chinese characters with that in mind?
Yes, I did. I don't think it's... We can give away a little bit about this ending.
Fair enough. You do
it. Okay. Early in the book, Dex is looking at Chen, and he says something about how angry he was with Chen. But now, looking back, all his rancor has bled off. He says, because I realize now that Chen had less than 2 weeks to live.
Mm.
So we know from fairly early on in the book that Chen's not going to make it, that he's going to meet some kind of American death. What we don't know is exactly how that death will come about.
Luke Wisnett, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. We're talking about your novel, Watching TV with the Red Chinese, marvelous title. Read to me again, would you please?
In early October, Channel 3's Cinema Classics showed Charlie Chan at the Wax Museum, and my neighbors, randomly flipping channels during a study break, happened on it, then sat transfixed by this flick, seeing themselves for the first time, I suppose, through American eyes. 2 hours of the great white-suited detective inspired in them a protracted and wacky, inscrutable Chinese kick. For weeks afterward, everyone and everything was honorable this and venerable that, and his roommates kept calling Chen number one son. This was subtly funny to them, these vulgar Hollywood stereotypes. They laughed silently with their eyes scrunched shut. They affected Charlie Chan's eloquent, broken English delivery, his languid hand gestures. Apropos of nothing, they'd offer ironic aphorisms, mostly non sequiturs and an occasional pun. Unloading groceries one rainy afternoon, Tzu announced, "Dog that eat, stay alive." And Chen told me in a high sing-song, "Man of thousand face, not shave so good." Leave alone honorable acquaintance, Hua advised, and go study for honorable math exam. And Zhu cuffed number one son good-naturedly. Chop, chop.
Well, here's the wonderful humor in your bittersweet book, Watching TV with the Red Chinese coming through, Luke Wisnett. Let me put to you a final question. If you're as down as you sound in this novel, at least imaginatively, on television as a unifying cultural metaphor, where do we look?
I think it's a very odd and disturbing time to be an American. And I don't want to sound too pessimistic about it, but this is a culture that's under a great deal of stress and pressure right now. And I'm not sure that something benign is going to emerge. It's really uncertain at this point.
Is it the responsibility of you novelists to supply us with some answers to questions like this?
No, I don't think so.
You enjoy your writing for its own sake.
I do. I think if whatever wisdom you might find in novels is wonderful, but I don't think that's the role of the novelist. Mm-hmm. The novelist is an artist.
Well, Luke, regardless of whether we should call you an optimist or a pessimist, I want to congratulate you on this wonderful novel, Watching TV with the Red Chinese. It is published by Algonquin Books of Chapel Hill, and you are a professor of English at East Carolina University. Thanks for coming by the Humanities Center.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. My guests were John Russell and Luke Wisnett. John Russell's new novel is Favorite Sons. Luke Wisnett is the author of Watching TV with the Red Chinese. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. Write to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 652. That's program number 652, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. When you write, please mention the call letters of this radio station. The National Humanities Center welcomes your comments. Next week, photography and culture in the American Southwest and in the former Soviet Union. Join me for conversations featuring William Brumfield of Tulane University and Alex Harris of the Duke University Center for Documentary Studies. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Neutrogena Corporation, the Daniel and Joanna S. Rose Fund Incorporated, and Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week, at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. First novels from two Southern writers, this week on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me for readings and conversation featuring John Russell and Luke Wisnett. John Russell will be here to talk about his new book, Favorite Sons, a saga of Southern politics and personalities. Luke Wisnett will talk about his new novel, Watching TV with the Red Chinese, a bittersweet account of cultures in conflict. Favorite Sons and Watching TV with the Red Chinese. Join me for readings and conversation this week on Soundings.